I was just thinking how nice it is to have all our little babies. All our little babies coming into our sangha. It's considered a great punya for a baby to be born into this teaching. You know, in the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna is worried. He's really worried because he's on the battlefield and he knows that he's going to be going into this big battle and that who knows what's going to happen. So he tells Krishna, you know, I feel like I'm really getting this so clearly and so I'm understanding, but then if I'm going to go into the battle, I don't know if I can hold all this, if I could remember everything, what will happen to me if I'm killed in the battlefield before I really have this, what we call nishtha, really clarity in this vision. So he was concerned about it. And so Krishna said, you know, don't worry. You'll never be what we call an ubhayabhrashta. It means somebody who's kind of caught in the middle. They've kind of left samsara, they've become a mumukshu, they see all the limitations, and they really want this knowledge. And they don't have a heart for samsara anymore. It means trying to really make your happiness to become full and complete by fulfilling your desires in the world. You've seen the limitations of that. So you can't go back. Once you see that, you can't go back. And yet, he wasn't completely clear yet. He hadn't had time to really own up this vision. So he was thinking, what's going to happen? You know, now in this state, I'm killed on the battlefield. And so Krishna said, you'll never become somebody who's kind of hanging there in the middle, you know, neither here nor there. It's called ubhaya, means of the two sides. You're neither here nor you're there. So that will never happen. You'll always either, you'll be born into a home of jnanis, you know, people who have this knowledge, and you'll pick it up from birth. You'll be in that satsanga from birth. Or you may have some things you have to live out, some karmas that you need to exhaust, in which case you'll be born in a house of dharmanishtas, people who are very committed to dharma. And then you'll have whatever experiences you require to kind of complete that. And then you'll meet up with your teacher. Either one way or the other, no problem. So when I see these little ones being born, you know, they're just born into a house of home of people of knowledge, and they're protected that way. It's such a great, great blessing. Very beautiful. So how did I meet Swamiji? Well, I know we all have really interesting stories how we came to this knowledge. Everybody has a very unique story to tell. I think that I was really searching when I was a teenager. And I happened to come across a book of the, what was it? I think it was a little paperback of the Bhagavad Gita. A little thin paperback, and also of the Tao. Lao Tzu's Tao. I was in one of those kind of bookstores in kind of a hip little town called Sausalito. And I was 13 or 14, and I had a girlfriend, and her mother took a bunch of us little friends to Sausalito, and we went to that bookstore, and I just happened to get those two books, and I just was reading them there, and then everything just kind of lit up for me, and I knew. I was so glad there was something that existed like that. So they became these precious books that I really held on to. And then I used to pray all the time that I would get to have a teacher, you know. And then I read this book called Autobiography of a Yogi. And some of you have heard this story from me, I think, by Yogananda. And there I was, 18, I think. And that book was so depressing for me. Because if anybody's read that book, you know, this one guy throws himself off the cliff because his body isn't pure enough to gain this knowledge. You know. His body was just not subtle enough for Babaji, I guess, or whatever it was, so. It was more yoga or yoga kriya, yoga orientation. But what was taught was that you had to be almost like walking on air in terms of your purity, your antakarana shuddhi, the purity of mind and all that. You have to be so pure and have what was called the upadhi, the body, mind, sense organs had to be very, 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 very pure to be able to gain this knowledge. And so he had gone to Babaji, who was one of the main teachers in this lineage, and he wasn't pure enough. So I don't know if Babaji asked him to jump off the cliff, or he told him that he would jump off the cliff, and he did. He did, and I guess he got another body, and then he was able to get the teaching. And my thought was. If even this guy had to jump off the cliff, what are we going to do? You know? That is really depressing. Yeah. Because there I was a Western, you know, young girl. So I had to just put that aside because I couldn't get rid of the desire. I really, really wanted to know. But I also felt like it was something that we couldn't have. You know, so that was really a difficult time. But I remember I was going to school, and I had just a little type of cabin. And one night we had a big party, and everybody came to this party. I don't know who was putting it on, but anyway, it all came to my house anyway, somehow. I was never much for giving parties, but anyway, this one ended up at my house, and there's a lot of people there. And there's all kinds of wine and everything imaginable. (Clears throat) And I don't know if you've ever, maybe they don't have this in Sweden, but there's this really cheap red wine. It comes in gallons. This is called Red Mountain Wine. You know, like you could get a gallon of it for $3. And so all the young people would be drinking this kind of wine. And I don't know if we had any grass or anything, probably. Anyway, everybody was carrying on. And I remember, remember exactly where I was sitting. And I had my bottle of Red Mountain Wine there. And I looked around, and I just looked around, and here I was, and I just thought, "Oh God, save me! Now is the time. Please save me." And you know, within a few weeks after that, I met actually Swami Chinmayananda, who's a teacher who some acquaintances of mine knew, and they took me to hear him in San Francisco, and I went to all of his talks, every single one of his talks in San Francisco. I had never heard of Vedanta or anything. And then he gave another series of talks in Napa. Then he went to Hawaii. This is when they were doing 10-day talks. I went to all of those talks, then I went to the 10-day talks in Napa. These are in Northern California. And then he went to Hawaii. And then that was my big moment. I actually went to see him off, but in the meantime, I put my passport and toothbrush into my purse. I hadn't made up my mind or even really took it very seriously, but I just did that. I had a passport because I had gone to Europe as a high school student spend a summer there for some program. And so I did. I put my passport and my toothbrush and silly, you know. But I got on the plane. I borrowed some money, you know, for some of my friends that were there. I got a ticket and I got on the plane. I didn't ask him. I didn't ask anybody. And I went to Hawaii. And then, you know, in this type of thing, they always find places for everybody who comes. So some young people took me in there in Hawaii, and I went to all of those talks. I never got very close to the Swami Chinmayananda. I kept a distance, actually, because I didn't want anyone to tell me that I couldn't do it. You know, it wasn't an option. And I didn't feel that close to him either. I felt close to Vedanta. And so then he went to Hong Kong, and I went to Hong Kong. And I remember calling. You asked. And so then I remember calling my parents. They had no idea I was in Hawaii. I called my parents and I said, you know, I'm going to go to Hong Kong, and I'm listening to these talks or something like that. I didn't know that I was going to go to India at that time. And I needed some money. So I called to ask them to send me some money. My parents are not like that. They're not generous in that way. Oh, yes, honey, let me just send you $3. How much money would you like? No. My father went. He was a very strict man. And he goes, I won't say it as loud as he said it, but he said, you get yourself home right now. You're so angry. So and I said, I'm sorry, Dad, I really have to go. Right? I said, I'll see you, and I hung up. That was it. Then I borrowed some money from this other guy, and I sold my car. I had a little Volkswagen. So somehow I finagled somebody to buy that car. This is all while I was in Hawaii. I got enough money, and I went to Hong Kong. And in Hong Kong, I went to all of the classes, all of the talks, all of the satsangs. And the Swamiji used to see me there. He'd kind of just look at me, but I would never get near him. I wouldn't get near him at all. And so there in Hong Kong, I ended up staying in a temple in the downstairs, in the basement of a temple, along with a lot of refugees, people who had, it was packed with people, and I had this little cot, and so I was just stayed in this temple, and then I went to all of the classes and everything, and then I made the final decision to go to India. And so then, again, I got on the plane, never asked anybody any permission, except that some of the people who were getting to know me there that were traveling also with Swamiji. And that's when they gave me the name Radha. Swamiji didn't give me that name. A bunch of the Indian community that were with Swami Chinmayananda said, "We have to give you a name. What shall we call her? What shall we name her?" And I was just going along with that. And this one fellow says, "Let's name her Radha. Radha." And then they all say, "Yes, Radha." Okay, so that was my name, Radha. Why did that name stick? Well, that's another story I'll tell you in a minute. So then I got on the plane, and this time I had to, Swamiji was flying in first class, and this was a plane where you had to walk by the first class, and I'm just walking by and I see him there, but I just go, quickly, and he goes, "You?" And I just went, and I just kept walking. And so then I find myself in India in the middle of the night. You know, the planes arrive like at midnight or so. And I got off the plane, and there I was standing in the middle of the tarmac. Because you get off in the, you know, you don't get off into the airport. You get off in the middle of the tarmac. And I was just, it was pitch black out, and I was just standing there. And I remember thinking, now what am I going to do? Now what am I going to do? But just as I was thinking that, the Swami Chinmayananda had sent his group of ladies who had all come with their families and whatnot to meet him. He sent a group of ladies over to get me. And so three or four of these ladies came over and they get me and they say, "Swamiji wants you to come. Come with us. You know. And so I just went with them and they took me to Swamiji's ashram, the one in Sandipani, right outside of Bombay at that time in Mumbai. And they took me there, and they dressed me up, and they gave me saris. I had really, well, my hair was about as long as it is now. I had long hair, and they gave me saris and put tilak on and braided my hair and fixed me all up. And the next morning, they took me down to meet Swamiji, Swami Chinmayananda, and then they introduced me as Radha, you know. And he goes, "Radha! Radha!" "Yes, Swamiji." And that's all. And he just went on with his satsang, and that was it, you know. But that day, Swamiji came, my Swamiji, Swami Dhananda, came. So that was all meant to be. And then these ladies, and I still remember Mrs. Bhagat and Mrs. Desai, all of these ladies, they got me all dressed up and everything, and they took me to here, to Swamiji, who was teaching, Swami Dhananda, who was teaching at Bharata Vidya Bhavan. And then that's what I was looking for. That was it. I felt like I had been traveling for lifetimes, like beginningless lifetimes, and I'd finally come home. It was just amazing. It was an amazing thing. And then from that time on, I was just with Swamiji. That was the end of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember going to it was only a 4-day talk series, and I felt like everything he said was just for me. You know, you feel that way sometimes when you're hearing a talk, that's just for me. How does she know? That's how it was for me. And then the talk came to an end, and I was like, now what will I do? Where is he going? What will happen? But Mrs. Bhagat and Mrs. Desai took me down to meet him, even though I felt like I knew him because there was such a communication, just because I was so focused on the teaching and just on him. But they took me down to meet him as he was starting to come off the stage and leave, and they introduced me. And he was very kind of stern. He just looked at me. Mrs. Bhagat said, Can we bring her to Ahmedabad? Can we bring Radha with us to Ahmedabad? And Mrs. Desai goes, she can stay in my house. Yeah. And so Swamiji just looked at me and he said, yes, come. He said, come. And Swamiji's not, I don't see him as very stern like that, but it was stern. It was, yes, come. And so that was the end of it. Then from that time on, I went to Ahmedabad and I stayed with Mrs. Desai, and I would walk, go to all the classes and come to all of the satsangs, and I asked Swamiji so many questions. Finally said, you give everybody else a chance. And so I did, and then he would give me the okay sign. And then he gave me so much, he let me just ask the questions and whatever, you know. And so then from there I went to Rishikesh. So that was another, Rishikesh, he was going for 3 months or something, where he stayed in his ashram there and taught all the sannyasis. And so Mrs. Bhagat asked whether, can we bring Radha to Rishikesh? Yes, yes, let her come. So then after Rishikesh, I didn't have to ask anymore. Then I was kind of part of the group, and then I traveled with Swamiji along with other students. We used to follow him on the train. We'd ride third class and he'd be riding first class, and and sometimes he would go by car, or sometimes he occasionally fly. That came a little bit later, but there were usually about 10 of us, or even sometimes more, that would follow him, and he would travel and stay like 10 or 15 days in one place. So we would all travel and be there. So then Swamiji would teach a morning class and an evening class for the public, a meditation class, a morning class, and an evening class for the public. Then he would give us a 10 o'clock class and a 5 o'clock class. And that would be for the students that were traveling with him. And also there were close students of his in every place where he went. And so there would always be like maybe 20 or 25 students, or 20 students, something like that, in for this 10 o'clock and 5 o'clock class, and then we went to all the other classes too. Yeah. And then Swami Chinmayananda wanted him to teach a 3-year course. There are a lot of other things that happened, but this is all kind of the main line of the story. A 3-year course, and we were all so excited until Swamiji said that women wouldn't be able to come. Because women, men and women together at an ashram, he couldn't even imagine how that would work, you know. And that was not possible. I could not relate to that at all. I could not believe it. But he was very convinced that it just wasn't possible to do that. And then Swami Chinmayananda went to Hawaii and he told one of his Western students that she could come to the course, having not realized what Swamiji had ordained. Okay? But Swami Chinmayananda was Swamiji's guru. And so... and we were so happy. And so there were 3 or 4 Western women. He wouldn't let any of the Indian ladies come. And it was just too much culturally to have men and women together. So he let the Western women, some Western women come, very, very few. And some of my Indian friends, they had to wait for 4 or 5 years or more before he would let Indian women. And like Brahma Prakashananda, the Swamini one who I love and study with when I go to India, he kept her away for almost 10 years. But he had her learn Panini, because he had her studying all of these kind of things. But when he finally opened it up, Okay, you can come now. So that was really a lot of scary moments, because the most important thing to you, or for me, was to be really with Swamiji and with that teaching. Yeah. And we used to have visa problems. Like every 6 months you had to renew your visa. And I had to go home once had Swamiji could pull some strings and get the visas renewed. But the first time I actually had to leave India, go home, stay there for a few months, and then apply to get the visa. So it was really traumatic for me, because I didn't know if I could get back for sure, and all of this type of pressure. And that's the only time that happened. And all of the other years, he was able to. He had relationships with the administrators there, and he had a good relationship with them, and so they were able to get our visas. But anyway, it was a wild ride. But I would say that I used to feel at that time, and even when I looked back on it, that was maybe one of the most very special, most beautiful times in my life. I don't know if I can say that now, but I could say it then, and when I look back on it, I look at it, it's just the most beautiful time to just be with the teaching, to have satsang with Swamiji, all of those classes every day. You don't have to do anything else except study. And I used to study all the time and be in satsang and go to all of the classes. And Swamiji never left. For 3 years, he just sat there. This is for the first course. He just sat there. He may have left for a day or so, maybe five times out of that 3 years. That's not how it was later on. He had to travel. He had a lot of other things he had to do. So he would spend good enough time traveling. But then, no, and classes were 7 days a week, you know, all day long. You know. And I never wanted him to leave. No, nobody did. You know, when he wanted to leave, we would all kind of, we'd all have to brace ourselves. We just wanted to be there and do it. And many of the students there for this first course and the second course had waited for years for Swamiji to sit someplace and teach all of these Upanishads and to teach Sanskrit and all the Brahma Sutras and Bhagavad Gita and everything, to just sit and do it. Because everybody was just traveling from here, you know. So there's never a chance to just sit and spend 2 months on one text or a year and a half on the Bhagavad Gita and that type of thing. So people have been waiting and waiting and waiting. So that first course was so dynamic because people had such a strong desire for it. You know, so. And then I thought I couldn't imagine leaving ever. But after the 3 years was up, I was ready to come back for a while. I came back for maybe 6 months, 9 months, and then I went back again. He did a second course, and I went back for the last year of that, year and a half of that. And then I started going back and forth. And then I got really sick in India, along with most of us. And so I took a break from India for maybe 20 years, and then 15, 20 years, and then I started going back with Swamiji every year from 1990 on. That's the story.
Yeah. How was that transition to start to teach, to be a spiritual leader yourself, from being a student to being the teacher? Was that a given for you, or...?
Well, when I was teaching when I was in India, because of the second course and all the times I was there. So, you know, just like in the courses that we have now, the students that have been there longer, have had more experience, they have more Sanskrit, they'll teach the students who are up and coming and need some more help, like especially with Sanskrit or just some satsang, with somebody who's been around longer than they have. So I was always in that position because I had been there longer. And then also there were a lot of students in the States who knew, especially Swami Chinmayananda, and then Swamiji himself had gone there twice, who really wanted to study, but they couldn't come over to India. They didn't have the freedom, the life situation where they could just come to India and spend several years. So they were really waiting for some of us to come back. You know, so I actually, when I came back into quite a big class. of Swamiji students who were just waiting to have some teaching. And then immediately, I mean, within just a few years, we ended up doing a 3-year course there that I was involved in, bringing Swamiji to the States. So then that moved so pretty quickly, it moved into doing a 3-year course in the States, which there was a kind of a ground floor group of people who put that together. And so we did a 3-year course on the West Coast, and then we bought Arsha. That was called Sandipani West in near Garberville. That was a beautiful course. It was right on the Eel River. And there were 60 people who had been waiting and waiting and waiting, you know, to be able to do something like that, but couldn't go to India for this reason or that. So 60 people, and we had a beautiful retreat center. And everybody got their own room. The way this place was set up, a lot of the rooms, there were 2 rooms with a bathroom in between, you know, and it was a big, kind of a big campus. It had everything that we needed. It had the lecture hall, it had a big dining hall, kitchen, lecture hall. It had all of these rooms. It had a house, a beautiful, beautifully laid out house for Swamiji where he stayed, and had satsang on one side where all the offices. And there were a lot of guest houses. We built a big barn for storage. And we built these outdoor bathrooms on a trailer. You know, but other than that, we didn't have to do anything. And it was right on the Eel River, which at that time was full and flowing. It was amazing. So we had a 3-year course there. And then we wound up that course and moved to, for 2 years, started Arshakulam, which was Swamiji's organization. That course was run, Swamiji was Swami Chinmayananda's disciple, and so he did that, we all did that under the auspices of Chinmaya Mission. And then they wanted to just take it over for themselves, so they took that, and we then started Arshavidya Pitam for Swamiji. And I was the administrative manager of that, so I was very involved in all of that. And then we bought the Arshavidya, the Arshavidya Gurukulam on the East Coast within 2 years. And then we ran 3-year courses there, and then 6-month courses and 3-month courses like that. And that's going on to this day. That's a very strong institution now. So then my whole life was kind of taken up with all of that until 1984, until about 1990. And then I was done with administration. Burned out. Permanently. So then I started going back and forth to India, and I came to the West Coast and just started teaching classes, and things became more simple. But I never noticed myself as being any kind of a teacher other than just teaching all the time. So you kind of grow into, as you get older, you grow into more of a being a teacher than just being somebody who's teaching all the time. You know, that's what happens when you grow old. Yeah. It's a very beautiful time. So. Swami Vagishananda was about 17 or 18 when I met him.
How old were you then?
About 23. I think I'm a few years older than him, like maybe 4 years, something like that. So maybe he was 18 or 19, I'm not sure. But how old is he now?
61
this year. He's 61? Oh, he's so young. See, I'm 7 years old. Then he was young. He was young. Okay. So he must have been like 17.
Yeah, came,
yeah. Yeah, 16 or 17. Right? He was 17, 18.
He said he came when he was, but maybe.
Yeah. When, how old?
He said he was 19.
19? Okay. To me, he was a very young guy. His hair was totally on fire. He was great to be with. Yeah. So that's the whole life. Very interesting. But things happen, your prarabdha, you know, that your karmas kind of handle things. So I had all of that time of being with Swamiji and running the institutions and whatnot. And then I kind of retired from it because it's a lot. It's huge. It's just a huge thing. And there were other people that were available to do it. So I kind of retired from that and went to Berkeley. And then I was just teaching my classes in Berkeley. And then CIS, this California Institute of Integral Studies, some of my students were going there. And so they were saying, you know, to the East-West Psychology, you know, why don't we bring Radha there, you know? And there was an opening, so these people called me in for an interview, and it just happened that I just clicked with them completely. I liked them so much, and they liked me, and then I started. They wanted me there to teach Vedanta in a traditional way. It was that university, or it's a very small university, but it was started by some Indian people who wanted to bring this knowledge to the West and kind of have an East-West balance, you know. And so they wanted some traditional teachers. So then I got that job in 1996. And I just kept that ever since, though I'm retiring from it now, I think, just because it's time. But that was, I just taught Vedanta like I teach it at home. The only difference is they had to write papers and I had to read them. That's a big job. But otherwise, a lot of mumukshus came through. A lot of the students who came to that school ended up coming to my classes and meeting Swamiji and going to India. And, you know, so it was kind of like, he loved it. He loved that some of us were teaching at the universities to bring this knowledge there. And they all, the really serious ones, would just come to my private classes and go to the camps and, you know, very nice. So now I have a little farm in the west of Redding. Redding is up in Northern California. It's about 4 hours, four hours directly north of San Francisco. And then you go east, you go west toward the ocean for about 40 minutes. It's right on the Trinity River. And I just love to be there, you know. It's just be away from the city. It's like here, you know, when you're here, you're away from the city and so quiet and so, you know, nature. And so I love being up there. And then I still have my place and everything in Berkeley. I haven't totally burned my bridges, so to speak, but just about. And now my Berkeley students and people are all starting to come up to the farm. So we have little 3 or 4 day camps up there, which is really nice. Just we don't have quite enough. We don't have what we need to really give a course. We could give courses in the spring, summer, and fall, but not in the winter. Kind of like here, it'd be pretty hard to give a course here in the winter, right? You'd have to have an igloo. But there, a lot of people camp. You know, we have lots of tents, lots of camping spaces, and it's really nice. Some of you have been there. We did. Emma was there with some of you. So now I'm going to start dragging you all over, just back to the States. Just like now, I'm telling all the students in Berkeley, you really have to. I want you to come to Sweden with me. Everybody wants to meet you now. Come on. Because you never, when every all of us get together from all the different places, we're all the same tribe, you know. So it's just so nice to meet the people around the world that are kind of part of your tribe, part of the people that you can deeply relate to. Anyway, Swamiji really left, Puja Swamiji really left us with some wonderful, wonderful teachers. You know, he really passed this knowledge on so thoroughly. Some people, and I think for some of us Westerners also, we have so much to give. But you can also go to India and study the Vedanta traditionally to any depth. It's just amazing what's available. So he really gave this sampradaya, this whole lineage, a real shot in the arm. It's kind of like another Shankara. He's our commentator. He's the person who's really saved the tradition or pushed the tradition forward and came at just the right time. And I think Swamiji also came at just the right time to give a real boost to the tradition and make it all so accessible to all of us, you know. And even the teaching methodology to really pass that on, the teaching methodology of the Upanishads. He passed that on so profoundly, you know. And also Nididhyasana, how to contemplate, and the guided, what he learned. He said he felt like Nididhyasana, contemplation, was one of the main great things that he passed on, Nididhyasana and the Pramana. You know, where you really have something that you can do, just expand and pass that on to the students. And he did that so thoroughly. So it's really wonderful. He lived a long time, a very productive life. And then he left.
How is that? Like when you've been student with someone for such a long time and then he's gone.
Well, you know, because I was in the States so much that I never felt away from him, even when I was in the States and he was in India. And so I pretty much internalized him, so I didn't notice a huge change. And the other thing is that he really suffered for several years. That makes a difference too. So I was with him for those last few years that were boring. Really, really tough. He handled it so graciously, he never complained, but wow, I mean, it was not an easy time at all. And so it became harder and harder for him to bear to do anything, you know, even though he did everything up until maybe the last month of his life. But all of it was really, really hard for him to do, like even to get to the class. So many people had to get him to the class and get him situated and so he could talk. And then a lot of the class, we would all be there and he would sometimes cough a lot during that. We would just wait. We would just wait, and then maybe he'd be coughing like for 10 minutes, right? And then he'd finally be over and he'd kind of look up and smile. Or say something like, say, excuse me. But, you know, we didn't care if we had to wait 20 minutes or half an hour. It didn't matter. We were just there waiting for this coughing spell to end. And then a lot of the time also, he would be just talking, all of a sudden, he'd fall just like that. He'd, like, you're almost in mid-sentence, he'd fall asleep. Okay. And then we would just sit there, and once in a while, Swamini Brahma Prakashananda, who's a doctor, she's the one that he wouldn't let in for 10 years because he wouldn't take girls. Okay, so she would be a little concerned, and she'd go up real quietly and take his pulse. And he'd be okay, so then she... So we would just wait, and sometimes... And then all of a sudden you go... And he would start from where he left off. And he was so proud of himself about that. He loved that. He would not forget where he was, you know, and he would just continue. And then and once in a while, he'll say, he'd go something like that, I slept. And it, you know, it was a very intimate time for all of us, you know, to be with him. And he also wanted to, he gave everything. I don't know, he couldn't give more. He gave everything. And in the end, like that last 6 months or more, he wanted to give everything. Like, what can I give you that will help you, that will really be useful, you know? And that's what he would talk about every time. And a lot of it's very personal, very intimate, just the things that will help you to really grow in this knowledge and to gain nishta, you know, gain real clarity in this knowledge. And so he would always want to share all of those things, you know. It was just, it was a really very beautiful, beautiful time. So he said a lot of valuable things. I, you know, Sharada sent me some tapes when I was not able to be there for all of it, but I would listen to them. One of the things that he said that I think was important, because he was always kind of like special. He had like a, it's easy to say, well, he can do all that because he's Swamiji. He can be like that because he's Swamiji. He's like an avatar. He's like a special, he has a special upadhi. He was born for this. You know, you can rationalize like that. And he didn't want us to do that. So he said, you know, I really worked hard for this knowledge. I worked really hard. And I was committed. I had a lot of commitment. And I teach this to my students too, and also because I realized the truth of it along the way. But when he said it, then I really realized this whole thing about antakarana shuddhi, having a pure mind, or having compassion, having patience, being kind, caring for others. All of these are beautiful, beautiful qualities, not snapping or being angry or saying, you know, being pushing people off or that kind of stuff. He never did any of that. But he didn't do any of that because any of those type of qualities he caught and worked on. He did pratipaksha bhavana. That means when you have that type of quality that isn't really your value, it's not really your value, like lack of compassion, when that would come up in him, you know, he would convert that into compassion rather than acting it out. Or if he felt some anger, he would not act that anger out. He would hold it, he would transform it in himself and give out the opposite until he didn't have those things. But see, it's easy for us to say, oh, Swamiji, he's just so full of compassion. He never has any, he never has anger. He always cares about you. Whenever, and everybody would say that you're with Swamiji and you feel like somebody loves you and cares about you. You know, it's never about him. It's always about you. You feel loved and cared about and wanted and all of that. But any of the, with kind of the more samsari type behaviors are things that he didn't have a value for, and he had a commitment to the other. So he started translating the word nishta as commitment. For a while, when we say jnana nishta, jnana means knowledge, when I was growing up with him, it was always firmness or rootedness in your knowledge, and the example, which is an example that's used in some of the Prakarana Granthas, these explanatory texts, would be for to gain rootedness in knowledge, you use that like a fence post. If you dig a fence post hole and then you stick the post in, and then you have to, you know, shove the dirt in and shove it in and shove it in until that post can't move at all. You would call that jnana nishta. You have no doubts whatsoever. You have clarity. So clarity was the next word that he used, clarity. You have clarity in terms of your knowledge. But that didn't quite take into account that commitment to knowledge, that commitment which means antakarana shuddhi, the purity of mind. And purity of mind, antakarana shuddhi in Sanskrit is better, I think, but it means that those qualities that are not in harmony with your knowledge or with your own nature, the ones that when you act them out make you feel bad and kind of wish that you hadn't, you know, or wish that, like when you're mean, you know, or you're spouting off because you're impatient with somebody, or you're irritated, or whatever, all these things that we're capable of doing. When you do that, you know, at least if I do, I would wish that I would not, that I wouldn't. You know, if I said something unkind, then it's not like I feel justified. I feel badly, you know. Now, but I still do it. Okay, so now, say with a commitment. That means if that comes up, he uses two words, the commitment, and when he's talking about that, he talks about alertness. That alertness, which means that way of being, you know, is not something that you value. It doesn't make you feel happy. It doesn't open up the environment. It doesn't bring love into the environment, you know. It doesn't feel good. But it's just habitual, you know. And so what if you have a commitment to working on those things, those weaknesses that you would rather not have, you know, to turn that around? And he had that commitment. That requires a lot of strength and a lot of consciousness, a lot of alertness. He did it more than most of us would do, you know, because, you know, irritated here or there, you just don't have the energy to be watching after all that stuff all the time, and so you just let it slip by. He didn't. He didn't let things slip by. And so his heart was huge. He also said, in the end, your heart has to be as big as Ishwara. It's true, right? Because you are the whole. That's the reality. You are the whole. And so you are, in fact, Ishwara. And the knowledge is you are Ishwara. You have to understand what that means. You know, it's not like this little jiva is now becoming Ishwara. But this jiva, this body, mind, sense organs, is part of the whole. You are that. And all of this is you. And so, you know, most of us don't beat on our leg, you know. Or if you have a thumb hangnail or something, you don't go, oh, for heaven's sakes. You don't attack your body, you know. You try to help, right? You try to help it, you know. So that is our natural evolution in our humanness. You know, and he was really serious about it, and he studied the Shastra seriously and all of that, and it shows for this person that is so huge. I used to feel like when he would walk around at the ashram in Sedersburg, where we had all these pine trees, you know, tall trees, I would see everybody was smiling. All the trees were smiling, all the birds were smiling. Everybody felt blessed by the hugeness of his loving presence. And he wasn't feeling anything. He was just being himself. Because it is who you are. You're just shedding stuff that is not you. And so you don't, as a person, you don't really notice it. Because it's just that you're not having to suffer these limitations or these painful ways of behaving because you've outgrown them. So he won't feel anything in just being himself. But everybody around him is so happy, really, you know. So he didn't want us to think, don't think I didn't work for this. I worked, you know. Don't take these things for granted. So with the knowledge you're not exactly working, you have a mindset that wants to know. And so that knowledge will just pour in. But in terms of this habitual ignorance and this habitual behavior, You have to have a commitment, because it takes energy to change these ways of behaving that are not a blessing for yourself or others. You know, it takes energy, and to decide to expend that energy in that way takes a real value and real commitment. So he spent time making sure we all understood that. So I'm really grateful for that, actually. All of his talks.
In your opinion, where did the idea of separation begin?
The what?
The idea of separation.
The idea of separation is beginningless. I'll tell you why. Just think of maybe a really good analogy for it is the dream. When you have a dream, okay? Because when you have a dream, the dream characters that are part and parcel of that whole, of the whole, it's not like they became ignorant. They didn't gain self-ignorance. Their orientation is a product of self-ignorance, right? Because they have sense organs and mind, which enjoy consciousness, but there's no knowledge that differentiates the conscious being that they are from the mind. The mind is the one that's got the problem, the one who is suffering from the self-ignorance. From the standpoint of the self, there is no self-ignorance, there's no problem at all. But it's from the standpoint of the minds of the individuals. And that ignorance is beginningless because it's kind of built into the creation itself. That's why it's, thank goodness there's knowledge, that you can gain self-knowledge. Then that makes the creation benign, really. And that there is self-knowledge to be gained, and then the truth of your nature is full and whole and complete, and so that you actually can gain what you're seeking, the wholeness and the fullness that you're seeking as a human being, that all beings are, let me be happy, let me not suffer, let me be whole and complete, that is your nature, in fact, that is actually who you are. And it's not like you have to travel to get that, but you do have to have that ignorance removed from the mind. And so it's just the natural condition of the jiva, of the individuals within the creation, until they recognize the problem and seek this knowledge. And at that time, the Shastra itself says, when somebody has recognized the situation, at that time they will meet a teacher. It's almost like the Vedanta itself is like an unattached sense organ. It's an unattached means of knowledge that once you're ready for it, then it's available to you. You know? And then once you know, then you don't need that pramana, you don't need that means of knowledge anymore, because that ignorance has been removed. It just takes away the self-ignorance that has allowed your mind to superimpose itself upon the self, upon your being, and then to superimpose also itself upon the body. So you become this finite person who's subject to birth and death, who is trying to make a way in this world which is different from me, trying to gain some happiness out of it, you know, all totally impossible to do. And then finally, you know, just think of beginningless birth. So here we are now, it's been a long time. finally you put it together. And you realize, and then you hold up, you just pray to Bhagavan, you know, please save me. There must be a way. There must be, because it's the innate desire of every human being, of every being even, that let me be whole, let me be complete, let me be happy. You know, but it's like running after a mirage or something, you know. Can never reach it. And then finally you figure it out. Okay. figure out that there's no way to reach it, but then you think there must be a solution because you've experienced moments of happiness. Moments when you've said, yeah, this is me, this is how I'm supposed to be. But then it just eludes you. You know, it kind of just wafts away as you're grabbing desperately to try to bring it back. Should we do it? I always do this one a little different than Swamiji, so I have to. You just keep doing it the way you do it, and I'll make my correction, okay? Swasti prajapya paripalayantam nyayena margena mahimahishaha ko brahmanebhya shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yam chobarahitah Ramanasam Tunir Bhayaha Om Sarvesham Shastir Bhavatu Sarvesham Shantir Bhavatu Sarvesham Purnam Bhavatu Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavatu Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pasyantu, ma kashchit dukha bhavet, asato ma satgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma